13. The Horn of Africa Ball. A few evenings later, Mona discovered an envelope stuck near the back of the brass mailbox outside his cabin. He hadn't checked for mail in days, assuming no one on the ship would write to him. He opened it to find an invitation for first-class guests to attend the Horn of Africa Ball. He was glad to have this reminder. The captain had announced the ball over a week earlier, and Mona was looking forward to the event. Seeing the words Horn of Africa in print reminded him just how far they had already travelled. Only 2 days ago they'd sailed by Alexandria, the city founded by Alexander the Great. Then they had passed through the engineering marvel of the Suez Canal, about which Mr. Socrates said, "The French built it for us British to use. Very kind of them." Modo had stared westward as hard as he could, hoping to see the pyramids. No such luck. And now they were chugging across the Red Sea, nearing the Horn of Africa. And to think that they were still only halfway to Australia. With surprise, he read the date on the invitation. It was tonight. He rushed back into the cabin and quickly explained the situation to Tharpa, who helped him dress in a white shirt with a black string tie, a black waistcoat, and a dress coat with tails. He combed his newly grown hair vigorously. "It will fall out if you continue such ministrations," Tharpa advised. Modo gave him a friendly punch. "Don't tease me. You'll be catching up on your sleep here in the cabin, so no one will be staring at you, but they will be ogling me. After all, I'm the son of a well-heeled gentleman. I assume I shall one day be inheriting his massive fortune." By the time Modo had fancied himself up, pressed on his silk top hat, and made his way to the upper deck, the 10-piece orchestra was already playing on the promenade and some of the passengers were dancing. He stopped dead in his tracks, stunned by the beauty of the scene. The ball had been planned to take place just as they were passing the Horn of Africa, the evening sunlight washing the flat, sandy shores with a red tinge. Even the Indian Ocean caught the warm light, against which were silhouetted gentlemen dressed to the nines and women in their fanciest gowns. It was all so civilized. This was what Britannia was all about. One of the cabin boys presented to him a dance card that listed the order of the dances, followed by a directive, "Gentlemen will remove their sabres and spurs prior to the first waltz." According to the list, he'd missed the grand march. The orchestra was onto a waltz now. Women in gowns of all colors and styles swayed alongside the men in black suit coats. Modo spotted Octavia on the dance floor, and, of all things, Mr. Socrates was dancing with her. She wore a dark red gown, her locks tightly bound. He wondered if Mrs. Finchley had helped her with her hair. He'd never seen such intricate braids, each held by a red bow. And she carried herself with remarkable poise. She easily passed as an upper-class lady. When the orchestra began playing a mazurka quadrille, Modo watched helplessly as Octavia accepted a dance with one of the more handsome officers. There was no time to waste. He ran to the far end of the upper deck and stood breathlessly before Mrs. Finchley, asking, "Will you give me the pleasure of dancing with you?" "Mr. Anthony Reed," she said with feigned haughtiness, "pleasure is not the proper word. Honour is." "Ah," he bowed. "Will you honour me with your hand for a quadrille?" She curtsied and offered her hand, and they joined the 11 couples already dancing. Modo had practised the quadrille years earlier with Mrs. Finchley. He'd had to imagine the other couples and the intricate pattern of the dance. As they began to move, Modo immediately realised that dancing with a real group would be much more difficult. At first he was awkward and sometimes lost the beat, but after several deep breaths and a few kind compliments whispered by Mrs. Finchley, he relaxed and his footing became more confident. "Be the song," Mrs. Finchley said quietly. "Feel its rhythm." The circular path of the mazurka meant that he occasionally found himself next to Octavia for a few moments. Sometimes he danced close enough to actually say a few private words. "You look absolutely first class," he said on one of these occasions, as he hooked his right arm through hers and they twirled around each other. "I know," she replied with a coy smile. "No seasickness on the Indian Ocean, my dear cousin?" "Not even a smidgen. Bring on the Pacific. She spun away, dancing with an officer in a fancy white coat with golden buttons. By the man's insignia, Modo could see he was a lowly captain's clerk, but he was a good 6 inches taller than Modo. The dance soon brought Modo and Octavia together again. You're looking rather handsome yourself, she said as she moved away. Keeping in mind, of course, that you aren't really yourself at all. The mazurka didn't bring them together again, to his great frustration. The orchestra finished, and the dancers all bowed to one another. When he looked up, Octavia was already with another officer, a lieutenant this time. Mrs. Finchley had been asked to dance by the grizzled captain, so Modo found himself standing alone as the orchestra struck up a painfully peppy polka. He was not feeling the least bit peppy. Modo threw himself down in a lounge chair. What exactly had Octavia meant by her last comment? Had it been a mistake to use the doctor's face with her? After all, she really knew him so much better by his night face, another from his repertoire. Maybe every time she saw this new face, she was reminded of how he could change. She had to get to know him all over again. Was that why she seemed so distant? But surely she could see it wasn't his fault. This was how he'd been born. Already the Horn of Africa was sinking behind the ship. It was certainly warmer this far south, but he still shivered. A waiter brought him a soothing cup of tea, and he drank it. They did have good tea on the Rome. Modo wanted to go back to his cabin and read, but Octavia would probably accuse him of sulking. So to pass the time, he watched the other passengers. He rehearsed their names and occupations. Then he matched all the men with their wives. Except for the priest, of course. These were the elite of British society. He wondered if any other members of the Permanent Association were on board. For all he knew, everyone on the ship was an agent of Mr. Socrates. Modo laughed nervously. Wouldn't that be something? And what about enemy agents? With that in mind, he surveyed the seated passengers. The priest would be a reasonable guess, as his collar would make him seem trustworthy. But the man was at least 60 and had a friendly manner when Modo chatted with him. He certainly enjoyed talking about birds. No, it would be too obvious to dress up like a priest. A doctor, now, that might be a good disguise. Unless someone suddenly became ill, then you'd have to prove you were a doctor. Mr. Carpenter was sitting alone, but very near Mr. Socrates, who was in conversation with the ship's captain. He leaned slightly toward the two men as though listening in. Modo ran through his memory of the past month on the ship. He'd seen the man many times, and he was usually alone. He'd been sketching out on the deck, so he was some sort of an artist. Modo had never heard him speak. The fact that he was alone might indicate he was a solitary agent. Mr. Carpenter glanced at Modo, their eyes meeting for a moment. Then he nodded and went back to looking out at the ocean. After a few minutes, Mr. Carpenter stood and walked down the deck toward the cabins. Modo waited several seconds, then followed him. He didn't know if he was responding to gut instinct or just looking for an excuse to leave the dance. Mr. Socrates had told him never to put too much stock in gut instinct. The gut is not the part of the human body that thinks, he'd explained numerous times. And yet, Modo found himself following the mysterious man. He watched as Carpenter entered his cabin and closed the door. Modo approached it quietly and stood outside, listening. All was quiet. Then he heard a click like a hammer being cocked on a pistol.